The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. No, it's not the dulcet tones of Seth Leibson's voice coming out of your speakers. It's Hugh Hallman filling in for this hour. Seth had to duck out for 1 hour. He'll be back in the third hour when I get to spend time with him again, I hope. But I am delighted and honored and privileged to have as the guest in studio John Shattuck, who served our state 20 years?
16.
I thought it was 20 years. Well, it felt like 20. It should have been 20. John Shattuck. Well,
much longer than that at times to me.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I don't mean that indecorously. John Shattuck served us in Congress and rose to effectively the number two position in the Congress. Well, I watched you on the floor.
Quite.
Well, but not just served the state of Arizona, but served this nation. And it's rare that we see those in Congress understanding the role from both perspectives, that we have an obligation in that role to bring the bacon home and do what our constituency needs for our state, but also to put it in context with what is important for the entire country so that our state also succeeds, but the country does as well, because you have to have both.
Exactly.
So Dr. Shattuck, as I like to call you, and you object, you are a doctor, Juris Doctorate. My wife gets very angry when I'm referred to as a doctor. She's a real one, and I'm just plain one on radio. So I'm thrilled that you're with us, and we have a variety of topics that we can go into, and I really want to open it up to you, but I'm going to stick you with a hard one. The state of Arizona is now in sort of a conundrum over what to do about its law from the 1800s on abortion. Our state House and Senate have not quite figured out what to do. And given your great experience, your great insight, your political acumen, what do you see and what do you think they ought to be doing?
Well, I think
let me pull the pin on that grenade and roll it toward you.
Happy to do it. Dealing with it when you for 16 years in Congress, addressing this is in my view not near as complicated as actually dealing with it when you had to vote. In some ways, I refer to myself as a talker now, and I've been talking with lots of members of the legislature, but they're the doers. They have to not only talk about it, they have to actually do it, and then. And this doesn't happen enough for legislators be held accountable for it.
But pay the consequences of whatever they do.
Absolutely. They are ultimately held accountable for it because they ultimately face election day and stand before the people and the people got to say, you know, I don't like what you did and I'm not voting for you anymore. In this case, I think they are in many ways doing what they ought to be doing. Perhaps not as quickly as a lot of people would like, or maybe as a lot of people thought, but they are struggling or muddling through it as legislatures are wont to do. The Founding Fathers created this structure where you had a House and a Senate, and most of the 50 states, I think all but one, have adopted that. And legislation has to pass both of those in identical form to go on to the governor and be signed or vetoed and become law or not. And in this case, the Supreme Court put a hot potato in the laps of the or the lap of the legislature, the laps of the two bodies, House and Senate, and they're proceeding by perhaps not normal procedure, but by their rules for dealing with an emergency of this type. I used to say when I was in Congress that Congress does two things well. One, nothing, and two, act in haste and repent at its leisure. And that was kind of pretty much what the Congress did while I was there and what it often Congresses or legislatures often do. To get kind of down to the nitty-gritty, the ruling by the Supreme Court that at a delayed point in time of some 10 days, and I don't know if that's the precise number or even why there is a delay, the court said the law, the governing law of Arizona is the law which was adopted in, I believe, 1864, before statehood, which prohibits abortion except it to avoid the death of the mother. And the issue before the legislature was, do we allow that to stand, or do we repeal it, in which case a law signed by Governor Ducey would become effective? And that is a much less severe law than the 1864 law in a number of ways. The 1864 law has no exception for rape or incest, and it imposes criminal penalties. And from a technical standpoint, many people aren't talking about this, but it also says that those penalties can be imposed on someone who performs an abortion or someone who assists, and I think it's in procuring an abortion. And as a lawyer, a doctor, I guess, of jurisprudence, that is a big red light to me, because what it really says, I think, pretty clearly, and a courts can work their way around these things, but it is not at all difficult to interpret the language of that 1864 as saying that a friend calls you at home one night and says he has a 15-year-old daughter whom he's just learned has become pregnant. The family has discussed it. They don't like abortion, but under the circumstances of that particular situation, they believe they need to get one. If the 1864 law were in effect and they said to you, you know, how can you help us? We can't get this abortion here. And you said, well, call. I have a college classmate who went on to med school. He practices in San Diego. Call him. You could be charged with assisting in procuring an abortion for their 15 or 16 year old daughter. And the reach of the law could say you are going to prison. So the legislature is trying to deal with that. And of course, the hot issue is, do they repeal the 1864 law and allow the more recent law to go into effect? That statute does have an exception for rape and incest. It also has a time period during which the abortion is allowed to go forward. I don't believe it has
unregulated.
I don't believe, but it's a time period that is in the minds of pro-choice voters too short.
And I don't believe 15 weeks.
15 weeks, and I don't believe it has criminal penalties. Though I'm not certain of that. Maybe you know. So that's the debate that's going on. It's now passed a version of a repeal of the 1864 law. Has passed the Senate, but under Senate rules, it needs to pass two more times before it can go to the House for consideration. The spotlight or the intensity has now fallen on the Arizona House, where the Republican majority in the House, a majority by only one vote, has procedurally blocked the Democrats from passing legislation that would repeal the 1864 law. And the question is, what are they going to do? Pro-life members say they believe, and I was, I think, 100% pro-life my entire time there. But they believe, for example, that abortion is the taking of a life. So how can they be asked to vote for that? And quite frankly, I don't think they should vote for it if that's their conviction. But right now, the consternation or the intensity is focused on the fact that the Democrats, who I believe either to a person or close, believe the opposite and would like to see the 1864 law repealed. And if it were, and there are enough votes clearly between the Democrats and those Republicans who are willing to go to the more recent, less stringent, less strident, less punitive law signed by Governor Ducey, that they could pass it if a vote were allowed. But so far, Republicans in the House have prevented there from being any vote. And that is where the situation sits at the moment, and where there are very intense feelings and beliefs on each side, and they need to be resolved one way or another. Of course, that all falls in the context of other things going on, including an initiative that will be on the ballot this November.
You've got wisdom from decades of service, not just in Congress, but also in our state as sort of a philosophical, moral leader, political leader. When we come back, I'd like to touch on just briefly kind of the advice you might provide.
Happy to do it.
To these folks.
Get myself in plenty of trouble with.
Yeah, right. And
either one side or both.
Yeah, well, and at this stage, you won't be pulled out of office, but, you know, your bride might not speak to you for the rest of the day. So I'm Hugh Hallman, joined by John Shattuck, a great servant for the state of Arizona. We'll be back in just a moment. We want to thank our friend Seth Liebsen for allowing us to take over his airwaves for a few minutes. And young David is gonna run us, so we'll be right back.
She's good. Do you watch?
Welcome back to the Seth Liebsen Show. I am here with the dear Dr. John Shattuck. Yes, he's a doctor of laws, not of medicine. Young David is joking because John and I were having such a good time during the break that we ignored the fact that we were coming back and we're commenting on a variety of things going on in our studio, even as we speak. I've messed up yet again and haven't even started our clock, so we don't even know what time it is. But here we are with John Shattuck.
We're having a good time.
Exactly. Well, I am. I hope you are. So here we are talking about, you know, easy things like abortion.
There you go.
Let's talk about abortion and religion and see, is there something else we could throw on the table to offend people? So John was speaking about the status of things in the Arizona legislature that really came about from two court decisions. We first have the Supreme Court of the United States making the decision to repeal Roe v. Wade effectively judicially and send this issue back to the states, which I actually applauded. I believe that's always been the correct place for it, that this is a state's issue and that we did not need the bench legislating a penumbra of rights and determining that we've got to make up stuff in the Constitution and instead let the legislatures figure this out. And here we are. We've got states across the country making very different decisions. And then a second Supreme Court, the state of Arizona Supreme Court, making a decision that, in fact, a law that was passed in the 1800s stands as the law of the land in Arizona, which, as Mr. Shattuck pointed out, says that abortions are fully regulated, that one cannot seek an abortion unless a woman's life as the mother is at risk of death, and that anyone involved in seeking to procure an abortion in other circumstances,
assist them,
can be prosecuted under criminal law as well as the abortion performing physician, and arguably under that law, even the woman who has the abortion. So all of those people would be in the eyes of the law criminals. And we are talking through how the state of Arizona's legislature and ultimately governor might handle it. And interestingly, in my view, we have the view from the hard left that a period of time of 15 weeks during which a woman could seek an abortion in an unregulated condition is a ban. And that the language even is spoken as that is a ban on abortion, when the data tells us that something on the order of 95% of all abortions sought during the Roe v. Wade era were sought in the first 15 weeks.
In that period
of time. So that if, as a political matter, we addressed a 15-week period as the opportunity for a woman without any regulatory constraints to seek an abortion, that we would be dealing with 95% of the issue anyway. And that leaves us with the challenging ones that end up in Senate debates on the floor with senators talking about that in one instance that from the left that an abortion should be allowed up to birth. And then the debate about, well, when is birth? If a foot is sticking out of a woman's uterus, vagina, is that a birth yet or not? And nobody being able or willing to answer those kinds of questions. These are really tough things to deal with in politics and in real life. And so, Dr. Shattuck, you've been in this business for most of your life. You have helped the state of Arizona and at the congressional level, the formulation of real policy and creating solutions. What would be your advice to our legislators?
Well, first, it is hard. And I think it is important that they're reflecting on the issue and putting energy into it to try to do the right thing. Second, I would note that your description just now reveals that you allowed the practical or the pragmatic or the sensible into your description by noting that, well, 95 or 93% of all abortions, in fact, occur in that first 15 weeks. And so if you simply use that to define the law and to say for a woman who is pregnant and is considering getting an abortion or not getting one, allowing her the first 15 weeks to make that decision is not going to leave lots of issues unresolved. It's going to resolve the vast majority, 70, 93 or 95% of them. I believe that politics has to be practical and realistic, and that if you are completely purist, it simply will not work. In this case, I think there are two difficult factors at a minimum to be dealt with. One is the law that the legislature is being told it should repeal is, in fact, out of step with current thought by the vast majority of Americans on the issue. I don't think many states have criminal penalties. I don't know of any that have criminal penalties that could be imposed on somebody who simply assists. And in an open debate, somebody was a congressman. That only meant the nurses standing around and assisting. But I'm a lawyer and you have to follow the words. So the example I gave of somebody calls you and says, how can I get an abortion? I can't have it here in Arizona. Or do you, even if you do know somebody in Arizona and you simply give them the phone number, have you assisted? So there are very significant problems with that law. And that's
you don't want to be the test case to find out whether or not the person who answered a question over the phone gets to spend time in prison. That's the issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is simply not reflective of even current drafting, which would not have allowed that to happen. At the other end of the spectrum is, I would say, the agony of any family that suddenly discovers itself in this position. I know I have a daughter. Fortunately, she's beyond the age where that is likely to be an issue. I have a son, and he's also beyond that age, but when they were younger, when they were in their years from, we'll say, 14 to 20, or maybe even younger than 14, and maybe even older than 20, I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about, well, what if that happened? Nobody in their right mind wants that to happen. And philosophically, my life, my belief has been that life begins at conception. Now, in vitro fertilization has created an issue there, which I had not confronted in my day in Congress. In my view, again, going back, I don't think members of the legislature who are rock solid pro-life and for whom repealing that law would be an offense to them, force them to do something they adamantly believe is wrong. I absolutely don't think they should have to do that. But that's not where we are. We're at this question of the procedure. And is it appropriate for, and this is what is happening here, the majority in the Arizona House of Representatives to stop the minority, that is Republicans, to stop Democrats from having a vote when I don't think there's any debate but that the majority of Arizonans think the 1856 law is too draconian, and it would pass, repeal of that provision would pass immediately. So right now they're using procedural motions. I think they ruled a Democrat effort was dilatory, and I don't think they ought to rely on procedural tricks to stop that vote.
I'm Hugh Hallman. He's John Shattuck. We're on the Seth Leibson Show here on 960 KKNT. The Patriot. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman here with John Shattuck, a brilliant government servant. Public servant is the right statement there, not government servant. You haven't been a government servant for quite a while, actually. Yeah.
Maybe I'd prefer you say anti-government.
Anti-government servant. Public servant.
Coming down in the tradition of Barry Goldwater, whose speeches and texts were written by my dad. Don't call me a government servant. You can call me an anti-government servant. I am passionate about freedom and about the founders and their vision of what this country should be.
Well, we've been talking about abortion as one of the examples of a very difficult thing to deal with, and I'm going to put it to you this way. You've now been out of government office as an anti-government public servant for what now, 8 years?
No, longer than that, I think. I left at the beginning of 2011.
Holy cow!
Yeah, so it's been 13 years.
13 years. Well, that's as long as you left just slightly before I left the mayorship, and I realize I've been out of office a lot longer than I was in office at this stage. But what I'm about to propose is perhaps you could explain to those who are in office that there are less painful things to do than not be in office.
There definitely are less painful things to do. And I guess it maybe depends upon your character or your inclinations when you're in, what you want to do, and the times. I, for example, went back at the beginning of at the start of the Gingrich Revolution, and Republicans had taken back the majority in the U.S. House for the first time in 40 years. And so there was lots and lots of adulation for our leaders, in particular Newt Gingrich, who had led us there, but then proved, like all humans do, that he wasn't perfect. And as Speaker, he made some mistakes. And our class as a group was more conservative than the members who had been there for a number of terms or many terms. They were much more moderate, and we wanted reform, and we wanted it now. And so we pressed leadership hard to change things, and we are at times at war with them. And I had plenty of instances where a couple of in particular ones where Newt and I would get in arguments on the floor with other members watching us, and he'd tell me, John, I need you to vote this way, and I would say, no, Newt, I don't agree with that. And in one particular occasion on an important vote, I said to him, and this was early on in the process, I said, Newt, if you're asking me as a favor to vote for you because as Speaker you need a unanimous vote, I would consider that. But if we're talking about on the merits of this particular issue, I believe you are wrong and I am right. And it was always, I had this vision that my job in Congress was to drag the conference or drag the whole Congress to the right. You know, not too surprising, having grown up in the shadow of Barry Goldwater with he and my dad talking philosophy in the living room. I was to the right of a lot of people there, although I take pride in the fact that when the young Turks in my class would make demands on leadership, we never demanded something they could not do. It was always something that was within their power to do. Actually, the shutdowns occurred not at the demand of our class. Some of the shutdowns occurred, for example, at the demand of others. There was one point in time when Newt shut the government down at the urging of he ran for president on the Republican ticket, and he was
Bob Dole.
Yes, Bob Dole. Dole and Newt shut the government down, and at the time I wasn't clear as to why they were doing it, and then they proposed to open it back up without having gotten anything.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I said to Newt, this is crazy. If we shut it down in response to a demand and then we open it back up and haven't gotten anything, and compromise is always what you have to strive for, and Republicans, you know, give way too much ground in all compromises, you know, we ought to get something before we open it back up, or we look like we were billing silly or irresponsible.
And it damages the brand.
And it damaged the brand.
Yeah, it damaged the brand repeatedly during that.
And I think that there were two or three other Republicans in the whole House who joined me in voting not to open it back up because it made it us look stupid.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing to deal with.
Absolutely.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. I'm with John Shattuck here on the Seth Leibson Show here at KKNT 960 The Patriot. We're grateful that you're listening. And again, Dr. Shattuck, we'll be back in just a moment. Young David, take us out. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman. Thanks to Young David for great bumper music. Seth complains about it all the time, but I'm grateful for all the crazy stuff you put up.
I actually love it. It gets me excited.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So, Young David, thank you. You just got high.
Good bumper music.
You got high marks from one of the, in my view, one of the finest public servants we ever had. And as we clarified in the last segment, the anti-government public servant.
There you go.
And I agree with him. We both were raised in the era of Barry Goldwater. His father worked directly with Barry Goldwater, writing his speeches and giving him the intellectual prowess that he became known for. My mother worked for the dear senator when he was thinking about running for Phoenix City Council and all the other kinds of crazy stuff that he was doing. She was a big fan and became a Republican because of Barry Goldwater, worked diligently then to get the state turned into a Republican state.
Which happened.
It did happen, and it's hard to believe sometimes. But you, of course, were brought into the Congress in the class of 94, which became the first time Republicans controlled the House in, wasn't it, more than 40 years?
40 plus years.
We had at the Nader, you had in, I think it was 1964, 66, only 135 Republicans in the House.
It got perilously low.
Right. And we complain now about how bad it is when we have a very narrow margin of majority and have been very close in the minority side. And yet it was really, really bad at the 60s, which I think gives some reason for why the classes that preceded you moderated their views. The only way they could get anything done to move the ball in the conservative direction was to moderate their views and try to get Democrats on occasion to support good public policy, which happened.
And there were, in those days, blue dog Democrats who, for example, on defense issues would see the world the way we did. Jackson?
Yeah, of course. So we had ultimately what became Reagan Democrats,
right?
Because they were, as you said, the blue dogs who were socially conservative, fiscally conservative, and tended to be militarily conservative or believed in military power being exerted by the United States, which brings us to a current issue. Ukraine. Let's choose another easy one, Mr. Shattuck. Ukraine. What do you see going on in the Republican Party, and what would you like to see going on in the Republican Party with respect to Ukraine?
I believe that the American people have been misled on Ukraine in that almost from the outset, this is a war that Biden got us into. I think he got us into by his debacle in the handling of Afghanistan and our being shamed or humiliated by how poorly he handled that. But on top of that, when we got close to the war, I don't know if people remember this, Biden said, well, he wouldn't be too bothered if Russia had a small invasion of Ukraine or a right. just. Yeah,
he would not risk treasure or lives on defending Ukraine.
And what I'm very upset about, and I say, quite frankly, at least some of the Republicans in the U.S. House today are, in my view, leaving me. I will never leave the Republican Party, but they are dragging the Republican Party into an isolationist stance, which I do not think can be defended. It may be true, and when you and I were younger, we heard it all the time, that America can't be the world's policeman. And in theory, there's some validity to that argument. But the reality is, if America refuses to be the world's policeman, then that and no other country with our values, rule of law, a democracy, individual freedom, individual responsibility, steps forward and the world goes in the direction it's going now. Are we OK with having China be the or North Korea or Russia be the world's policeman? In this case,
let's throw in Iran.
Yeah, let's throw in Iran. Exactly. In this case, I am with those Republicans who say no more forever wars. To me, the lesson of the Vietnam War was absolutely crystal clear, and it was what we now should use to guide us, which is never go to war if you can avoid it. But if you have to go to war, have a plan to get in, win it quickly, and get out. And we did not do that in Vietnam, and it was a disaster. And then along came the Middle East, and our leaders, including President Bush, led us into another forever war. And to me, that's inexcusable. But there is no reason that the Ukraine war in its early days needed to be a forever war. What Biden did wrong, and this is his fault, but also the Congress's fault, is they went to war, but not committed to
piecemeal.
Yeah, not committed to doing enough for Ukraine to enable Ukraine to win. So Biden and the Congress have allowed us to get into what now is looking a little bit like, or perhaps a lot like, a forever war. But worse than that, one of the problems you learn about America is that we don't keep our word. We tell our children, you have to keep your word. My wife told me before I married her, she said, two things you have to do if you raise children. One, set rules. Two, actually enforce the rules. And in this case, we've gotten ourselves involved in forever wars where we don't set rules or we don't enforce the rules. In this case, I believe that the first issue we should have looked at is the fact that when Ukraine separated from Russia, it had one of the largest stockpiles of nuclear weapons in the world. And the United States and others, I believe Britain and France and
it was
more.
Actually Great Britain, Northern Ireland, and Russia signed the Budapest Memorandum in 1994 that said Ukraine would give up its nuclear weapons in exchange for those four countries honoring Ukraine's borders. They were sacrosanct.
And so now along comes Russia and
a signer of that memorandum.
Of that and of course, the United States, I believe, agreed also to defend Ukraine if, or on the condition that if you'll give up your nuclear weapons, we will defend you. Now along comes Russia. They invade Ukraine and take Crimea, and nothing happens. Then they start the latest war where they invade Ukraine. And they don't ask us to live up to our word and defend Ukraine, which would have meant U.S. Army personnel, U.S. Navy personnel, U.S. Air Force personnel. They just say, we want the weapons. And they fight tenaciously at the beginning of the war. And now we're dribbling supplies to them in a way that is killing them every day. And I think it's inexcusable. We either should have broken our word and said, yeah, we told you we'd defend you if you gave up nuclears. Just kidding. We're not going to help you at all. Which I think is wrong. If we allow Russia to take Ukraine, we are setting the precedent that every country in the world that has nuclear weapons or claims it has nuclear weapons can raid its neighbor or attack its neighbor. Russia can take Taiwan. China can take Taiwan. North Korea can take South Korea. And the United States will stand back. In the statements where the president condemns Iran for launching missiles at Israel, he says, oh, but we don't want war.
It is inexcusable. I agree with you completely. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's John Shattuck. We're going to be right back in about, I don't know, young David's driving the bus here, and I keep putting us in the ditch. But
we'll be right back in two minutes. But we always
make it back. So
thank you, young David.
Thanks to David.
Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. We've just spent this hour with former congressman and hero of mine, John Shattuck. He served us brilliantly, not only for the state of Arizona's interests, but for our country's interests. Fought diligently the fight to cut the budget, to keep crazy spending down.
And we balanced the budget. People don't remember that.
Oh, I do.
In the Newt Gingrich Revolution, we balanced the budget for either two straight years or three straight years.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton took credit for it.
Yes, absolutely.
But
Reagan's admonition is it doesn't matter who gets the credit. By the way, it's Reagan's admonition that if you want to preserve peace, you need to prepare for war.
That's right.
Five words or seven words that Mr. Biden never read or understood.
Well, and I'd go one better for the current Republican Party. That was the Reagan admonition that you don't treat 80% friends like 20% enemies.
Right.
That we need to do a better job as Republicans bringing our team together. And the Arizona legislature has now got this kind of infighting we were just discussing at the beginning of the hour. What do you think, with 2 minutes to go, your advice would be going forward?
Well, I do not believe in the Republican Party or any party in America becoming isolationist. It seems to me that those Republicans who are opposing the Ukrainian war and not wanting to equip the Ukrainians so they can defend themselves, they apparently believe that if Russia gets mad at us, they will have to launch sailboats to try to get to where they can attack the mainland of the United States. Somehow they've missed the point that ICBMs exist in Russia, and if they lose their temper with us, they can launch those here. So they apparently believe, well, you know, if we have to give up Ukraine, maybe we then have to give up Poland and Czechoslovakia, and then ultimately maybe
Germany.
Why not Germany? You know, the French, they're not great at defending themselves, so we can give them up too. And then apparently these bright isolationist members of Congress figure that Russia will get in its sailboats and we'll have, you know, say, a couple months notice before they're on our shores. Somehow they need to wake up and realize that that's not the world we live in. And Reagan's doctrine saying the best way to preserve peace or achieve peace, keep peace, is to prepare for war. And if Russia can just take whatever neighbor it wants to, then why can't China? And on down the list we just discussed.
Yeah, so we end up with the tripartite group of China threatening Taiwan, Russia in Ukraine, and now Iran trying to make sure that we destabilize Israel in a way that will be permanent. Thank you, Congressman, for joining us today. Thank you, Seth Leibson, for giving us the opportunity to spend time on your airwaves. Seth is going to be back here in about 5 minutes. So at the top of the hour, I get to join Seth, and I think we're going to be talking about discrimination and the challenges we face in the Republican Party as well as in this country in stabilizing our politics. So
hope we got people thinking.
We do have people thinking, and John, you're one of them. Thank you for generating that. We'll be back in
just a bit.
Happy
to be here.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.